This is the story of John Randall, a black American slave who wound up being on the First Fleet. One of the first lucky 800 to 1,000 people, Europeans, well, in this case, from Europe, who landed in Australia in 1788. Hello, this is Peter Hill Explains, where I touch upon interesting topics to try and explain. I hope it informs you and it helps me recuperate and get the art of speaking again I require as a teacher. So John Randall is very interesting because he is one of two black African slaves or black African people from Britain who were swept up and in the First Fleet, as convicts in the First Fleet, and came out to Australia. And his story is a very interesting one in that it gives us an insight into what Australians could do, what the early settlers could do and can't do. And it also gives us an insight into how we have reimagined our history in so many ways without the very influential impact of America. So 1788 is about the time of, I think it's 1776 is the American Revolution, just less than 10 years after it, or a bit of, or 12 years after it, we have the founding of Australia and a new idea that America's closed down, we need a new place to place our convicts. They were normally taken out to the Americas, and we have to have a Australia imagined by the British without American content in it. And so Americans actually do play a very interesting part to Australian history. And they have been excised, and if you add them back in, you get another detail, another understanding. If you sort of understand, say, the way that water flows on a landscape, you get another appreciation of what's going on, how water flows underneath the landscape, as well as on top of it, you get a view of what could be happening and why certain things went certain ways. Now, John Randall, he was a black African slave. He was born in Connecticut. And it's quite interesting because you read a bit of an Australian history and it stops, and you read some American histories and they also stop. They can't translate the world between the world of America and the rather closed world of Australia. So we know that John Randall was a slave of someone called John Randall. And so if you can imagine, I suppose these people, which are basically bodies for hire, and you would name them your surname with, I think, John, Tom, and Harry, Tom, Dick, and Harry would be different names for all slaves, so they had no name or personality. So John Randall's story is an interesting one in that he got swept up in the War of Independence, and the black Africans really had nothing to gain from American independence because that war was the war between the British colonialists, the British colonial authority under George III, and American slave owners. So if you can remember that George Washington was a slave owner, and he used to walk along his plantation, ride along his plantations, talking about his slaves. So black African slaves play a key point, and the British, I suppose, were outmaneuvered a little bit by the Americans early on, but it was a bit of a cold war. They still required Britain and European to sell their goods and to provide stuff that could not be provided in America. And a lot of people still had ties with Europe, so it was a bit of a cold war, and the British were trying to work out what to do in various ways. I suppose there's an insight I have from playing with war games and reading histories. The British had a army from 100 years earlier, and the Americans had a more modern light infantry army, and as the British continued after the War of Independence to fight on the continent, fighting with the French, which had associated light infantry with their big regimental columns, had light infantry built into it, the British became more and more adapted to light infantry warfare. So by the time, I think it was 1812, so the British returned to avenge the American burning of York. The Americans were going to flex their muscles and go into the remaining British colonies. The British had a small elite expeditionary force which went down and down the Potomac River and burnt the home of the American president. And the flames caused the fire damage, so they slapped white paint on it, and it became the White House. Interesting, but we go back a bit further to this interplay between the British and the Americans, and what happened is that the British began to experiment using slaves as soldiers, and of course this represented a slave revolution, and slavery was being abolished in Britain. So this was a cause for fracture with the British or with Europe. And so the Americans were very, very hostile to traitors. You can imagine how lowly they thought of black African people who joined the British. And there are stories, I don't know how true they are, of the slaves being caught in a river and the Americans shooting them as they tried to cross the river. I think this is, if I can remember, an important part of John Randall crossing over to the British. And when the British withdrew, they withdrew with John Randall. And he wound up a black African slave, born in Connecticut, to a slave owner, walking the streets of Britain. Now, if you were a soldier, you enjoyed a pension, except if you were black. So John Randall, who had learnt to shoot and fight in the American Revolution, was in Britain. And again, I'm going off memory. The main aim of this is not for accuracy. It's for me to talk and give a story. I think he sold a silver watch. I'm not sure. I'm just going off my memory here. So he was taken over and put on a convict ship to be deported or taken to a sentence in Australia as the first group of convicts. And the group of convicts were taken, I think, in 13 ships, two Royal Navy ships and 11 ships for hire. So if you can imagine moving 1,000 people. I think it's 1,300 people went out in the first fleet. It's very much like a very large school going to a sporting event and all the buses turn up. So each ship is sort of like a double-decker bus, could take 100 to 200 each, and they all went in the ship. There was a female ship and a male ship that and there was, I suppose, problems of probable mutinies and things like that. And they took this group out to Australia. They first arrived in Botany Bay, which there's a series of three water bodies which make up Sydney: Botany Bay, Port Jackson, and a river to the north, the Hawkesbury River. The Hawkesbury River is a more idyllic farm-filled river. Botany Bay is a large bay. It's easy to get into, but it's very exposed, very shallow. And Sydney Harbour is one of the most beautiful deep water harbours in the world. And so you've got an array of harbours. So they went first to Botany Bay on the reports of Sir Joseph Banks, saying this is a great place. We'll go into Joseph Banks's role in the colonisation of Australia. They landed in Botany Bay, had a small expedition, and decided to go north and explore for other places to go to. And they found, through Sydney's heads, this amazing, through a narrow set of heads, a huge bay open up. Now, I suppose it's important that there was a huge storm which nearly sunk all the ships as they came through Botany Bay. And even today, this is a sort of feeling of a spirit, the spirit of the Aboriginals or the occupants, cursing the people as they came across. And so they landed in Sydney Cove, an area which modern Sydney has grown up. And just going back into the structure, as soon as the fleet arrived, the other 10 hire ships, hire coaches, went out to raise more money as they want, because they were ships for hire. They weren't specialty ships, and so they went to earn money as cargo ships and vessels up through Southeast Asia. So you follow them up there. So this group was left with some whaling boats and two ships and some supplies to last a short time to when the second fleet came, and our John Randall's in this group. The second fleet, of course, came. They wrote a different contract. So if you imagine contracting someone to go, so it's a long different change from, I think, the Mayflower, when the first settlers came to America. They had a Dutch ship. I think they hired two ships, and one ship was sinking, was unseaworthy, so it slowed them down many times. And so they had this rather overcrowded ship which arrived in America. It's had a much more perilous landing. In Australia, they landed with the convicts and the Marines. So these were professional soldiers. And so at this stage, John John Randall arrived in Australia, and he is recorded very early on. So you've got these professional soldiers, and very early on he became an instrumental person in Australia as Australia's only crack shot. And he was the gamekeeper to the sort of elite group of people who ran the rest of the penal colony, because I imagine this, so this is from reading the accounts, they'd taken with him, and a few people would shoot at various game. Of course, he would knock it out, and then he'd have to say, good shot. And so they'd take him on these shooting expeditions, and I think it's definite that he's the first person to have shot a lot of Australian fauna. He's definitely the first person to shoot and kill an emu. So these people were going around and shooting things. It is interesting that Joseph Banks used to, when he was going with Captain Cook to Australia, used to stand out at the top of the boat with his gun shooting birds as they circled the boat. That gives it another view to Australia. And of course there's another whaling history to Australia. They had whale boats, and so besides getting rid of Americans, we've also got rid of our whaling history, which came in here. So he's John Randall, and he's, because of his time in the American Revolution as a soldier, he's been very useful as a crack shot. And we know that he married, and this gives me great amusement, the Second Fleet came out, and the Second Fleet came out with his wife-to-be, which is Fanny. Now, the Second Fleet is a different story. They wrote a different type of contract, and they said it's for the number of bodies, dead or alive, transported out to Australia. And I think you can guess it. An unscrupulous hire company back then, they were more interested in delivering bodies. So the Second Fleet came out. They did a number of major things. To avoid mutiny, they put all the food on one boat. I think this boat sank, which meant that the Second Fleet arrived really hoping that they'd come to a spanking brand new place called Sydney. And I have to rewind here. Sydney was founded as part of a grand strategic move in Britain. The British and Russians were fighting, and Russia had key assets required for the British Navy. They had access to the rope building material, the flax, I think it is, the flax to make their ropes of the ships, and they also had access to the large wooden masks. So they were, I think Catherine the Great was the person there who, in the grand politics of Europe, threatened the Britain, and Britain more as a theoretical strategic move, said, look, we're going off because we've found a great place in the Southern Ocean which has got all the requirements. It's got the... we can just wind up there. It's got heaps of ships, and that's Norfolk Island, a little island north of New Zealand, and had the great advantage is that they had no inhabitants. That was a really important point. So I make this point that the British were actually going to Australia. There was a penal colony, but there was a second mission to build or have a second source to make them independent of the Russians. This point in time, a fairly complex thing. You remember the Napoleonic Wars were still to occur at this place, 1788. So the French Revolution was on high. Things were all a mess at this point. We'll go back a bit more. The I suppose amazing thing is that when they arrived in Australia, they took the best convicts, most able convicts, and the most able administrators, put them in boats with one of the two ships, and sailed off to form a second colony. Within weeks, and so you've got key people. You've got the merchants going away, leaving people. You've also got another key nucleus going away. And the incredible thing that very few Australians know is that a second Sydney was founded in Norfolk Island. They were running out of names. They weren't too imaginative, so they founded a second Sydney. And Norfolk Island lasted a long time before it was abandoned and replaced, after years of being abandoned, with the people who were in Pitcairn Island. It's a fairly interesting place. So it's sort of very also interesting that our first pictures of Sydney, one of the first things they do is they go into Australia and start chopping down trees. Why would you want to do that? Well, one of the ideas is that they're just seeing who could chop down a tree competition, which were the good axes, and so they took this up to the good axes and the good axemen up to Norfolk Island for their second secret mission. So it was a fairly complex thing that was going on, and they also had a series of marines. Not too many. I don't think it would be more than 200, about 100 soldiers all up. And so marines were like the US Marines. They were naval-based infantry. So infantry which went around on ships. And I suppose the elite there, and there's another story to be told about the psychopathic Marines, which set Australia on, I suppose, a psychopathic path. So there's Ross there. We've still got our John Randall sitting about the place. And so the Second Fleet arrives, and these are very, very sick people, and rather than them being put to work, the poor inhabitants of Sydney had to go around building the first Sydney hospital to try and resuscitate these barely half alive second fleeters. Now, one of the second fleeters was a lady called Fanny. I think she was 30. Yeah, 30. She lasted a year, and she was a oyster merchant who had fleeced a customer of some money. I think it's just some money, probably a handkerchief or something like that. And in Australia, we know what oyster merchant means, but in America, when they tell the story, they say she was an oyster merchant, and you know, fancy being sent to the colonies for just being an oyster merchant. Oyster merchant was code for a prostitute. I'm not making it up. That's the truth. You go through and read the histories in details and cross-reference it, and mostly in your head. So this John Randall was around the place, and he was a key shot. He went through a series of wives who died, and he had a series of children. And he took a grant of land, I think it was, in northern, what's now a suburb of northern Sydney, 60 acres. So grants, if I can get to you, a Commonwealth grant. So Australia took possession. The first settlers took possession of everything, and the convicts had nothing. And so in order to get things going, they gave them grants. So they'd say, I gift you this land. You have title to this land. So a grant is sort of like, I suppose, government theft. And they gave him some land to farm. By this time, they had basically a competition, who can farm anything. And there was a person who knew to put compost and grow seeds. So when they went out there, they realised that no one could farm. Another thing which sent them back is that the British were in the habit of, I don't know, shortchanging everyone, and they would go along Africa to trade, which is trade for slaves. And what they'd do is they'd give slave-grade tools. They'd look like normal tools, but they'd actually be cheap and not work. And so they'd give these people off, get the slaves, and sail off. And by the time the people actually went to hoe or do anything, use these tools, they'd fall apart. Pretty shonky, so to speak. So you've got John Randall. There's just a few more stories of him. He went back into the New South Wales Corps. So what happened is that they sent the professional soldiers out on the advice of the Admiralty. There's an interesting document. I don't know how I come across these documents, where the Admiralty is talking to Banks, to Joseph Banks, who advocated Australia. Why he did it? It's hard to know. Australia had this sort of curse above it, with it, in terms of the Great Barrier Reef twice had wrecked British ships, so there's a sort of an aversion to Australia. From Cook had a dreadful time when he travelled north of Sydney. He got his ship got ripped up by the reefs. He had to put it on shore and actually put a sail over the big gashes in his ship before it could be repaired. And then I think Cook then limped into Batavia, which is in Indonesia. Oh, he limped into Timor. No, it wasn't him. That was the bloke before, which I'll talk about. It's sort of an amazing story. And then, of course, Cook, who had looked after all his crew, lost them all to malaria, and it sort of devastated him when he went up to Indonesia, because he had to repair his ships. So, getting back into it, going all the way back to Australia, we've got John Randall there. Now, talking about this, they put professional soldiers in, and it's an interesting document. They ask about, well, will the natives be a threat? Because we've Norfolk Island, we've ticked off, there's no one there. Banks said with authority that you don't need many soldiers because the Aboriginals are passive and they'll move away, so you actually don't have to fight them. And this is, I suppose, an issue when you look at Terra Nullis, that they, in the Admiralty documents, do actually believe Australia is possessed, but will believe that they can actually bully or push away the natives without having a big war. So they really brief their commander on how to not create a native uprising. So there's a different views there. And I suppose one of the interesting things is that no one could really shoot in Australia. And so you have lots of things of, I suppose, Strawberry Hill uprising. It's various uprising, and neither side could really lay a blow because no one could really shoot. And I suppose going back, you're trying to really reverse engineer. You've got this John Randall who's a crack shot, and really no one else can shoot. They really bumble around, so they steal weapons and then they make a stockade, and no one can shoot. So the army comes along and attacks them, and there's not many casualties. It doesn't look as though many people could really shoot back then. So you've got to do it, John Randall. And the important thing is that the professional soldiers, who are small, really small, enough to actually get discipline, internal discipline, but not really enough to defend the colony against an uprising from the Aboriginals. And so they made a big calculation going out to Australia. If they had to send out 1,000 troops, that definitely would have gone ahead. And the troops cost a lot of money, so the colony was supposed to be a financial proposition. You go out there and, like a second America, you get it going. Of course, as a second America, the last thing you want to do is have the actual Americans there, which is the seed of destruction for your colony. So there's a reason, a deep reason, to rewrite Australian history without these Americans. So I think very few Australians know the multiple connections and cross links between American history. So our story really takes an interesting turn at the New South Wales Corps, which was of militia. These are ex-soldiers, veterans, and people like that who had an odd grab bag of history. Basically were the rum. They had an economy of rum because they had no money at the place. And these actually had a de facto revolution that was... The colony really was run by sort of a militia, and sort of Bligh had to come back. So Bligh came, and he was unpopular, and they got rid of him. But the entire time, and then they had to send back a professional military person to get it under military control. So during this time, when the people from the First Fleet, soldiers get back on, and they handed their weaponries and uniforms across to, senior citizens, people, a militia. John Randall joined this militia and had a role in it. Interestingly, if you can imagine the archetypal picture of the, that's the wrong one. It's, American Revolution, they have the little fife flute and the drum. Well, his thing was the musician. He could actually play a little tune and tap his little drum. So it's the person who was doing the music for these people, who's the, sort of the first military musician, as far as I can tell. The crack shot and a strapping, I think it was various reported at 6 foot or 5'11", so by the stams, a giant. You've got to remember that the size of people wasn't as big back then. And as the story winds up, there's a very interesting story where Irish convicts... So this is, I suppose, the injection of racism. It's hard to understand how this all played out. It's really hard to get your mind around it. Irish convicts blacked their faces and attacked... his house, I think, bashed a few people out and went into the night. And so you've got a report of these bizarre events. And I think he obviously eventually died. And his children went into a institution for Aboriginal girls. So even though they were, black American Irish descent girls, these two girls wound up in institutions, and the institutions eventually got dissolved, and these girls got fostered back out into Australian society. So there's lots of very interesting views, ideas of cultures, how we see cultures, and the fact that we've edited edited John Randall out of Australian history. We've also edited out some of the racial tensions internally in Australian society, very early society, and some of the stories which come from a racial view from other groups. You have to remember that the Irish were an oppressed, very poorly treated nation and taken out. They were very uneducated, they had no education whatsoever. In fact, a lot of the Irish believed strangely that they were in the Northern Hemisphere, and they believed they were in the Northern Hemisphere because they saw icebergs, because to actually come down to Australia you can't, it's very difficult to actually just cross the Indian Ocean. It's actually much better to go right down to the Roaring Forties, the huge seas, and you just catapult across to Australia, and you hook underneath Tasmania, and you take a turn upwards. And so this is why Hobart was all important. And there was concerns that a lot of Australia was actually owned by the Dutch. It was called New Holland at the time. And so there's a lot of angst in Australia. And so a lot of the Irish were pretty poorly educated, and so poorly educated that they would just throw down their tools, and start walking north from Australia, really geographically confused. And where were they walking? They were walking to China. So there's a story there. So that concludes the story of John Randall, a very interesting aspect, under told story or not told story in Australia whatsoever. And the point here is for me to get my speaking, talking ability back, and the more podcasts I do, the easier it is for me to just take control and thread a story in class and tell a story in class. That's 32 minutes so far. Thanks for listening. And in the meantime, if you're not doing science, research histories and have a real think for yourself, and just allow the documents to fill your brain and cross-reference things. That's what I did with mentally constructing this John Randall story from, I don't know, really only about 30 documents, looking at 30 documents and 30 stories. But it's very interesting, and also interesting to understand the viewpoints and the limitations of the frameworks of the people speaking it. That sort of gives you a second dimension to the timeline and story that you're trying to put together. So thanks for listening.